Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Hey, welcome to today's edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. Before I get started, it's real important that I point out that as many of you have either watched or listened to the webinars or the videos or the audio before know, I'm fond of saying I'm an attorney, but I'm not your attorney. And what I mean by that is that I cannot provide formal legal advice. This is purely an academic discussion, and absolutely no part of the presentation is either presented as legal advice by me, nor should it be construed as such by you. So for any legal advice regarding the discussion, please consult with your attorney. I am Bruce Allen Barnard, and this is the Bruce's Broadcast, or Broadcast Blue, Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar, now on the Broadcast Blue channel. This is the fourth in the series that we've had since the new year started, doing this every Wednesday. And we have our case of the week. And this one is the case of the Bus Blues, our case of the week for edition 2018, the fourth edition, 2018-04. Today's case is United States versus Azor, and this comes to us from the First Circuit, United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit up there in New England. And the date of the case is just January 26th of 2018, so it's just been a few days. Always try and get it to where you hear it here first. Before we get started on the facts of the case, share with you some key phrases and the blue key cases, the key cases that are going to be discussed in the opinion itself. Key phrases: probable cause, pretextual stop, the collective knowledge doctrine, which I've talked about a couple times before, but it's always good to be reminded of that, and search and seizure. The blue key cases: United States versus Ross, Illinois versus Gates, Ornelas versus United States, and Illinois versus Andreas. All cases that you should be very, very familiar with, but it's always good to see how they're used in different sets of facts and how they're applied in different situations. So let's go ahead and take a look at the facts real quick and see what was actually going on in this case. In March of 2014, DEA agents obtained a federal wiretap order to intercept phone calls and electronic communications in connection with a suspected drug trafficking conspiracy that they thought was taking place out of an area of Maine, my adopted home state of Maine. And this was Lewiston, Maine, where they thought this distribution conspiracy was taking place. The DEA agents intercepted telephone conversations between a person that they knew as Dastino and another person that they knew by the nickname as Cash. And so Cash is an alias, a nickname for this person, whoever it is that Dastino is talking to. During the intercepted conversations, Dastino and Cash discussed a plan whereby Cash would take a bus from Lewiston down to Boston and buy about 1,000 blues, what they refer to as blues, which is the 30 milligram oxycodone tablets. The plan was for them to, these 1,000 pills, they were going to split them so they each had about 500 to sell when he got back from Boston to Lewiston with these 1,000 pills. On a second intercepted call, they discussed how Cash would take a specific bus from Lewiston to Boston at 1:50 in the afternoon, or 13:50 for that military time, take the bus from Lewiston to Boston and would return to Portland. He would come back. Instead of going to Lewiston, he would go to Portland so it wouldn't appear suspicious. He wouldn't appear at the Lewiston bus station twice in the same day. And then in another call that was intercepted, Cash refused to go to an apartment in order to collect money from Dastino because Cash believed the area was too hot and it was risky. It would be risky for him to possess too large an amount of money. And so a different plan was made. They agreed there that Dastino would take the cash to the Lewiston bus station with what he referred to as an elderly. So whatever an elderly is. Having this information, the DEA agents contacted Maine State Trooper Tom Pappas, who was assigned to a joint task force with the DEA for the drug interdiction. The agents shared all of the information they had intercepted with regarding this with Pappas and instructed him to conduct surveillance at the Lewiston bus station and to wait for this person nicknamed Cash to show up. And at the Lewiston bus station, while he was there, he saw the 1:50 p.m. Greyhound bus parked on the street. And then he saw a red truck behind the bus that he recognized as belonging to a person named Carrie Buntrock. Now, Carrie, she is a 60, she in her early 60s, and so a little bit older, although I don't know if that'd be classified as elderly, especially as I get older in the years. But anyway, Carrie Buntrock, he knew that this truck belonged to her, and he also knew, Trooper Pappas also knew, that Carrie Buntrock was connected, was an associate of Dastino's. And he sees a man that he did not recognize get out of the vehicle and go onto that bus, that Boston-bound bus, that 150 bus to Boston. And he noticed the man, what he was wearing, saw what he looked like, noticed he was wearing a blue jacket, a black hat, and the bus departs the station with the man on board. Now, Pappas relays to the DEA what he had seen. And they told they told him that the man who boarded the bus could be returning from Boston the same day with a load of drugs. And at about 10 o'clock that evening, agents intercepted another call between Dastino and a person they knew as Pierre Dubois. And if these names, all of these names are sounding kind of French, they are. These are French, they're Haitians with French surnames, the people involved in this. Dubois told Dastino that he had dropped off a man at South Terminal in Boston. And the DEA then told Pappas about the call and said that the suspect, who is this person nicknamed Cash, could be on a bus destined for Portland, Maine. And so Pappas drives to Portland, to Portland bus station, to conduct surveillance. And he observes a bus arrive at the station. And he's not able to see who's getting off the bus, but he sees the passengers as they leave the bus terminal. And as he's watching, and he's in Portland, Maine now, as he's watching, Pappas saw the same man that he had seen earlier board a bus in Lewiston bound for Boston get off of this bus in Portland. He sees the same man, and he exits the bus terminal, and he gets into a taxi. The man's wearing the same clothing that he saw him wearing earlier in the day. It's the same person. So Pappas follows this taxi onto I-295, which is a bypass part of the turnpike system down there. And then he gets northbound on I-95, which is head north towards Lewiston from Portland. And for those of you not familiar with the turnpike, the interstate's a turnpike in Maine, the I-95 stretch. It's only about, it's a little bit more than 36 miles if you take that route from Portland to Lewiston. It's just a little over 36 miles. And if you do the speed limit, it's about a 46 minute drop. So it's just, it's not that far. Because Pappas, now he's not wearing a uniform. Trooper Pappas is in plain clothes. He's part of this drug interdiction task force. He is driving in an unmarked cruiser. He had earlier, he sought assistance from a Maine State Police trooper named Robert Cheka, and C-E-J-K-A, it's pronounced Cheka, who Cheka is in uniform, and he's driving a marked police cruiser. Pappas had previously explained the situation and the facts to Cheka and asked him to remain stationed at a point along the turnpike on the northbound side towards Lewiston from Portland. And so he's sitting there waiting. And as he followed the taxi, Pappas relayed the taxi's location to Cheka. And once the taxi passed Cheka's location on the turnpike, Cheka followed the vehicle for over 10 miles. And what he's doing is waiting for them to commit a traffic infraction. So that's kind of where that's at. At this point, now it's a turnpike, and there are tolls where you either go through them, you pay the toll, or you drive through kind of with your easy pass. This is actually a picture of the toll booth in question. So while he's following the taxi, Trooper Chayka, he's waiting for some type of traffic infraction. He observes the taxi going 41 miles an hour as it approaches the gray New Gloucester toll booth, where the speed limit's only 35 as you proceed into and then through the toll plaza and kind of force you to slow down. And so he's speeding. He sees him doing 41 and 35 through this toll booth. After the taxi drove through the toll booth, Chayka pulls the taxi over. Pappas had also called a Maine State police trooper, Jerome Carr, and his canine, Zorro, to help investigate the suspected drug smuggling here, the drug trafficking. Chayka informed the taxi driver that he pulled him over for speeding, and then Officer Chayka requested and received a driver's license from the passenger. And the passenger in the car, they didn't know at the time, but the passenger in the car is the defendant. The person who comes off the bus and into the car, his name is Pierre Azor, and that is the Azor that's in this case. But when he asks for his identification, this passenger hands him identification, and the name on the license is Vladimir Azor, and a different person, different name. And it actually turns out the license is suspended. But Azor tells Chayka that he had spent the night in Portland and was now going to Lewiston. And Officer Carr and Canine Zorro arrived approximately 20 minutes later. So you've got these three officers on the scene. And 20 minutes after the stop, Officer Carr arrives with Canine Zorro. Zorro sniffed along the car doors, and when he gets to the passenger side front door where Azor is seated in the passenger side, Zorro lifted up to the windowsill of the open passenger side window, puts his paws up. He's an Alsatian. He's a German Shepherd. And he goes up to the window, puts his nose directly on Azor's jacket sleeve, and then he immediately sits down because he's a passive alerter. The way that they train the canines, if you're not familiar, some canines they passively alert. They sit when they detect whatever it is they're trained to detect. And this is Zorro is a drug detecting canine. When they detect what they're trained to detect, they sit down if they're passive alert. That's their passive alert signal. And that's exactly what Zorro did here. A car orders the two occupants out of the taxi, the taxi cab driver and the person with the ID of Vladimir Azor. They order both of them out of the taxi. And then once Carr orders him out, he asks Chayka to do a pat-down frisk of Azor. The pat-down frisk reveals that Azor has a bus ticket, and it shows that he went from Boston to Portland from only a few hours earlier. He wasn't able to explain why he had lied about his trip. He continued to search Zorro. They get Zorro back in the car. Zorro searches the vehicle, and being the good canine that he is, the Zorro search leads to the discovery of a plastic bag, they say about the size of a baseball, underneath the passenger seat, filled with 1,075 blue pills, later identified as oxycodone. Chayka arrested Azor and booked him in the Cumberland County Jail. And then while he was there, he confessed that the driver's license was not his and that his real name was Pierre Azor and not Vladimir Azor. But wait, there's more. You might be thinking to yourself, self, there we go. There's the facts, but there's more. Because after the stop, 2 days later, Azor's no longer in custody. Law enforcement intercepts another call between the person on the phone that they know as Cash, his nickname, and Destino. And this is Azor. And Azor thanks Destino for bailing him out and tells Destino that he would repay him. And so Cash now is positively identified. The person Cash that they had heard earlier is identified as Azor, the person who was actually on the bus. And in another call, Azor inquired whether Destino had any Molly, and then the two discussed drug sales and prices for the blues that they actually had. And during the following month, Azor and Dasano continued to set up sales of drugs over the telephone, with Azor often asking Dasano for blues. And finally, on May 22nd of 2014, DEA agents obtained and executed an arrest warrant, a search warrant rather, for Azor's residence, and seized the drugs. A cell phone, and the phone number on the cell phone matches the number that was intercepted as belonging to the person with the alias of Cash, and a heavily used scale, and then $4,000 in cash. So those are your facts. And now we've got it. So they've connected a lot more of the dots. So instead of just a simple possession with intent to distribute, a P. Whitty case, we've got conspiracy. There's a number of people who are indicted, and including Pierre Azor. So in his suppression hearing motion, and at the subsequent hearing on the motion, Azor argues the stop was pretextual and that the police did not have either reasonable suspicion to conduct a Terry stop, an extended stop. Remember, it's 20 minutes from the point in time that there was the stop for the traffic infraction to the point in time that the officers showed up, the officer car with a canine Zorro showed up. It was 20 minutes. We're kind of looking at facts similar to Rodriguez, I guess, in the eyes of the defense attorney. He said, since the stop was pretextual and they didn't have the reasonable suspicion to conduct a Terry stop nor the probable cause to stop the car and search the taxi, that it was therefore an unreasonable search under the Fourth Amendment. In this case, Azor reasoned that the information that the police obtained prior to the stop was insufficient to corroborate the information from the wiretap and other sources that the police needed. They needed additional evidence of his identity, of Cash's identity, before they could determine that the man that they saw getting onto the bus was the same person that was on the telephone that they were referring to and was making these telephone calls under the alias of Cash. They said there just wasn't enough corroboration in place at the time that that stop took place. So the defense attorney here did what defense attorneys do. Hey, that's not fair. Filed a motion to suppress the evidence that was seized as a result of the stop and the search of the taxi. And remember those downstream dominoes too. There are a lot of this information that was obtained from the actual stop of the taxi and the seizure of those oxys was undoubtedly an integral part of the subsequent search warrant that led to the search of the house, which led to the phone that identified him positively as Cash, because the phone had the same number as this person named Cash. So I'm basically making an argument that there's a bad domino in your Fourth Amendment domino lineups, as I'm fond of saying. But the district court denied the motion, and he ended up being sentenced to 36 months in prison, and he appeals. So that's where we're at. On appeal, he asked Azor asked the court to find that the district court's conclusion that the officers had probable cause to search the taxi was incorrect, and he specifically argued that at the time of the search, that their observations, the officers' observations, were insufficient. What they saw alone was insufficient to corroborate what had been gathered over the wiretap. Couldn't connect those two dots sufficiently in order to establish the probable cause that they needed, and therefore they didn't have the probable cause to stop and search. The only corroboration that law enforcement had, this is according to Azor's attorney, was Pappas' observations of a man getting out of a red truck belonging to someone who Pappas recognized as part of the investigation and boarding a bus in Lewiston and later getting into a taxi in Portland that headed toward Lewiston. In the defendant's view in this case, the information was left largely uncorroborated, the information from the wiretap, and that there was nothing about the information obtained by law enforcement that allowed them to identify the man who actually got on the bus to go to Boston and got off the bus when he came back as the person identified as Cash. So let's take a look at a few blasts from the past and some of the Supreme Court rules, the rule of law developed in some Supreme Court decisions that are going to be at play here. First, we have United States versus Ross, which is one of the the string of cases from the original Carroll decision. This is an automobile exception case, and it helped further refine the concept of the automobile exception. Talking about that this morning as well, the whole concept of, remember when the automobile exception first came out in Carroll, it was because of some type of exigency, time exigency. But as the cases developed, Supreme Court cases came out from the 1926 or 28, whenever back then when the Carroll decision came out, through the last 80, 90 years, there was a redefinition and refining of the definition to where there was no exigency required. And we've got a case pending in front of the Supreme Court, which is kind of interesting in that regard, the covered motorcycle case. We'll be talking about that when the decision comes out. But the rule of law from Ross, the important rule of law in this case, is that a search of a vehicle does not violate the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable search and seizure if it's based on facts that would justify the issuance of a warrant, even though the warrant has not actually been obtained. So what they're saying is, what does it take to get a warrant? Well, no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause. It takes probable cause. So if you have a vehicle and you have probable cause, then a warrantless search is not unreasonable, and therefore it does not run afoul of the Fourth Amendment. And that's United States versus Ross. The next one is, I believe, one we had just last week. We talked about this in the Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar previous to this one. We talked about that was a probable cause case. Remember, probable cause is a fluid concept turning on the assessment of probabilities in particular factual context, Illinois versus Gates. And remember, that's always in the totality of the circumstances, and you don't look at each specific little tidbit or fact in isolation, that you look at all of these facts in the totality of the circumstances, as we learned last week. And then another very famous case, the Ornelas versus United States case. Police have probable cause to search where the known facts and circumstances are sufficient to warrant a man of reasonable prudence in the belief that contraband or evidence of a crime will be found. This is one of those many cases where the Supreme Court has really tried to come up with a short, concise definition of probable cause, what it is that probable cause means. It's very elusive. It's very hard to define probable cause. This is just one of many attempts by the court to do that. What some would refer to as the reasonable belief standard. So you have a reasonable belief, which is above reasonable suspicion but below reasonable certainty. The whole concept of the reasonable belief standard or the prudence. And then we have a very important case for the concept of the collective knowledge doctrine, and that is where law enforcement authorities are cooperating in an investigation, as here, the knowledge of one is presumed shared by all. And this is important because what this does is it allows us to accumulate knowledge with many different law enforcement officers. And as long as it's shared, the probable cause can be shared. The facts can be shared from one law enforcement officer to another. Indeed, if a law enforcement officer saw a known suspect, a person known to everybody, you have Joey Bag of Donuts, he's known to all the local law enforcement community. One officer sees him rob a 7-Eleven and run away, and the officer is not allowed, or for some reason he can't get to the guy. He's not able to catch up to Joey Bag of Donuts. And so he does a bolo and he says, "Hey, look, be on the lookout for Joey Bag of Donuts. I just saw him rob, the Handy Pack convenience store." And then another officer sees the person he knows as Joey Bag of Donuts running down the street. He could effectuate the arrest on that shared probable cause, that probable cause that was shared, developed through one LEO and shared to another. I'm not going to get in. There's different types. There is vertical shared knowledge and there is horizontal shared knowledge. And whether it's shared vertically, as it is in the example I gave to you, or horizontally shared, as it is in this particular case, is a little bit beyond the scope of what I want to talk about. It would certainly take much more than the 30 minutes that I've allotted. Maybe it'd be a good topic for a webinar one day just to talk about the collective knowledge doctrine and the difference between vertically shared information and horizontally shared information. But regardless, when you've got this information and the facts are shared as they were in Illinois versus Andreas, and indeed as they were in this case, then this collective knowledge can be used to establish probable cause. And that's exactly what the First Circuit said in this case. In the instant case, the circuit court said, we agree with the district court that the collective knowledge of law enforcement officers involved in the investigation, viewed objectively, established probable cause to stop the taxi, search Azor's a person, and search the vehicle. Now, armed with the knowledge of the sex of the person, the gender, and likely the race of the suspect due to the Haitian nationality, that they knew that, the purpose of the trip, and the detailed and very unique itinerary, law enforcement sought to corroborate the information. And the intercepted phone calls revealed that Cash would be leaving Lewiston on a bus bound for Boston at approximately 1:50, and that Cash would, this person nicknamed Cash, would return to Maine from Boston later the same day on a bus to Portland. And before going to the bus station in Lewiston, Cash would meet Dastino, who would be accompanied by what person, an elderly, and would give Cash a ride to the bus station. And at the bus station, Pappas witnessed Azor, a black male, exit Bunt Rock's truck, and she's a woman in her 60s, close to elderly, I suppose, known by Pappas to be associated with Dastino. Pappas witnesses the man getting onto the bus, heading to Boston, watches the bus depart without him getting off, and all this information is corroborated. And they later intercept another call, and he's going to come back on a different route. He's going to come back into Portland. He sees the same guy. Pappas sees the same guy come off the bus in Portland soon after it was scheduled to arrive. His presence in both of the exact places where Cash stated that he would be, especially in light of the nature of the intercepted itinerary, corroborated that this man was the same person that was being referred to on the telephone call. So this collective knowledge is going to corroborate all of this in this particular case, and they said that it did. Now, the court also noted Azor's contention was that the timing of the stop indicated that the probable cause did not exist, but the court said, look, just because you have probable cause or just because you take further steps once you have probable cause doesn't mean that you didn't have probable cause when you did it. And the court said they had probable cause. They could have stopped that taxi at any point. But remember, Pappas was in plain clothes and he was in an unmarked car. He didn't want to tip. And there was continued investigation. Remember, they had other things going on. They didn't want to tip off Azor, the person they knew as Cash. They didn't want to tip him off that they were onto him and listening to these telephone calls because there was more investigation going on. And just because they did other things did not prove that they didn't have the PC to stop the car of ab initio, which they certainly did. Very good discussion on all the facts and the corroboration. And then they affirmed the district court decision based on all of these facts. So there you go. A nifty little tidbit, nifty little thing that was happening. What if, remember in the facts when I told you the dog went up to the car and put his paws on the window and then actually put his nose on the jacket sleeve of Azor in this case, and that's what led to the detection of drugs. What if they didn't have probable cause or a probable cause to search the car at that time? What if the probable cause had not existed? Would that sniff have been lawful under the Fourth Amendment? And hearkening back to Jones, and I've been waiting for a case to come out where the dog actually touches the car. To see if there's going to be if the court's going to say, hey, that's an unlawful search, that the dog cannot physically touch the car under that trespass theory, the Fourth Amendment searches that was espoused in the United States versus Jones. But we didn't get it because they already had the probable cause. So the dog touching the car was no big deal at that point, even though the district court said that the dog sniff helped further the argument for probable cause. You had to have the probable cause before the dog touched the car, or that could certainly be problematic. Interesting set of facts in the case. It's too bad. We'll have to keep waiting. Been waiting for 6 years for one of those cases since January of 2012. We haven't had one yet. We'll see what happens. Want to say a good job to Trooper Carr and Canine Zorro. If you've listened to my webinars before, you know I'm a big dog lover. Love to give credit where credit's due to folks when I can, and give a shout out and say good job. This is actually a photograph. If you're watching the webinar, this is Trooper Carr, and that is Canine Zorro, and just a beautiful German Shepherd there up in Maine, as you would expect with a coast and the lighthouse. So good job to everyone involved in that case. So there you go. Thanks for joining me in this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar on the Broadcast Blue Network. If you join me live, I want to thank you for joining me live. If you didn't join me live, I want you to know that you can. And you can go to Broadcast Blue for www.broadcast.blue. Our name is our website address. You can get information on how to join us live right here in the live room as I'm conducting the webinar, where I provide goodies. I provide some downloads and some extra stuff that you don't get when you watch the video or listen to it on the podcast. You can, on the website, get more information about upcoming webinars. Also, check out the Twitter feed at the bottom, and we're going to be tweeting more update information. We're going to try and turn that into a real-time legal update feed on the bottom of the page. How to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. The audio podcast are available for replay on the Broadcast Blue podcast, and that is available on both iTunes and Google Play. And how to stream the video. If you can't join us live and you want to watch the actual video and see the slides and see what the folks who are in the room with me see, we're on Vimeo. We have our own Vimeo channel, and that is at www.brownbag.video. So you can go to www.broadcast.blue and get all the information with all the URLs on how to get to these three different ways to join us with Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinars. So thank you so much for what you do. Gone just a couple minutes over, but we're going to stick close to that 30-minute schedule. And thanks for joining me. Those join me live. Thanks for joining me live. And let me hear from you. Hear from folks. Bruce at broadcast.blue is the email address. You can drop me a line, and it's always great to hear from you. So I'm coming from Alexandria, Virginia today, but we'll be back in Jacksonville, Florida next week to come to you from Jacksonville. So thanks again for what you do, and I hope to see you next week on Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinars.